There isn't an uninteresting page in How God Changes Your Brain, breakthrough findings from a leading neuroscientist. It's in paperback. Andrew Newberg is the main author. This he also co-wrote the book, Why God Won't Go Away. Mark Robert Waldman is his co-researcher and author of How God Changes Your Brain. This is a scientific study of the impact of prayer, meditation, even just a core belief that there is something more than us. Doesn't even specify what God is, and yet just that alone will change your brain. And you know all those books that have come out that talked about how the big problem of Western civilization, for that matter, world history, has been a belief in a God, and that if we took that out somehow, our history would be like paradise. Not so fast, says Dr. Andrew Newberg. His research begs to differ on that coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Well, let me do your propers properly. Dr. Andrew Newberg is an associate professor at the Department of Neurology and Psychiatry at the University, at the Hospital at the University of Pennsylvania. He is an adjunct professor at the Department of Religious Studies, as well as being the founder and director of the Center for Spirituality and the Mind. And there's a bunch of other stuff after that, but that's good enough. Good evening, Dr. Newberg.
Good evening. Thank you for having me on your program.
Well, you know how this conversation started actually was because of a movie called Limitless, which is coming out next week. And it proposed the notion that that we would have what would our lives be like if we could access 100% of our brains?
Sure.
So, you know, that sort of got us talking about doing a good brain show again. And your book came up and we jumped all over that. So thank you. But let me ask you that. What percentage of the brain do we all use on a daily basis?
Well, I guess to some degree, we do use all of our brain. When you look at brain scans, you find so many different parts of the brain are active all the time. And in fact, the brain is never not active. When we're asleep, when we're awake, when we're doing anything, it's always on. I think sometimes the 10% notion frequently comes from the rate with which different nerve cells in our brain die, so that by the end of our lives, you know, we've usually used up about 10% of our brain cells. And I think sometimes people think that that means that that's all we use. But I think more likely we're almost always using all of our brain cells. The question is, how are we applying those brain cells together, and are they all working together in an optimal way for us? And clearly we can always improve the ways in which our brain works and expand the abilities of our brain, and perhaps there are abilities of our brain that we haven't even tapped yet. This is something for science and researchers to figure out down the road as to exactly how much and how well our brain can be used.
Or Hollywood, you know, researchers or Hollywood.
Or Hollywood, that's true.
Now, but as to that subject, though, and again, we'll get into sort of the meat of this, if we can use that word, in a second. But for those people who suffer traumatic brain injuries, and we've been watching the progress of, you know, Congresswoman Giffords, and think that's really cool that she's on the mend.
Right.
But we're reminded a lot of how some people can even have half of a brain removed.
Oh, absolutely.
And function completely normally, which then again speaks to that subject that somehow that we have a lot of extra brain that we don't really activate, and that we could be using more of it somehow at the same, all at the same time in a coordinated way than we do.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned a couple of examples, and there are many more where people have lost substantial chunks of their brain through injury, through birth, through, you know, whatever means. And it depends to some degree on exactly where and how that happens. And certainly when we lose part of our brain as children, where the brain is still growing and developing, we have a much greater opportunity to recover overall function. If you're, you know, in your 60s and you lose a substantial part of your brain to a stroke or head injury, you can usually recover some function, but it's very difficult to recover a lot of function because you know, while the brain does have some flexibility, it can only go so far. But you know, we see so many interesting cases where we're able to reactivate the brain, where different parts of the brain can take on new functions and so forth. And it is remarkable, and it never ceases to amaze me as I study individuals with different brain issues, that to see exactly how amazing the brain is and how much it ultimately can do.
Before I get, well, maybe as a way of getting to your book, let me back up to last hour. We were talking about what's happening in Japan and how so many people are devastated by both this earthquake and then a tsunami. And on top of that, appears to be a core meltdown in one, if not two, of the reactors at a nuclear power station in northern Japan. And people are feeling devastated, and people are feeling at a loss. And even a caller last hour talked about a certain amount of empathy fatigue that he's experiencing with all of the disasters after each other. Where is the brain's role in that? And how is it that we can improve our brain function at a time of disaster through a belief in God, as you see the neuroscientific research on that?
Well, I think that whenever we face something stressful, something anxiety-provoking, something traumatic, like what's going on in Japan, like what happens in so many people's lives, maybe growing up, maybe dealing with the loss of a spouse or something like that, the brain triggers very strong stress responses, and it releases different chemicals that on one hand, we need to be able to respond to stress. In fact, if we don't respond to stress, then we're not going to survive very well. So the brain helps us, to some degree, deal with those kinds of very difficult situations. On the other hand, when that stress becomes extreme, when it becomes prolonged, then it ultimately can damage the brain. And this is where we start to see things like a belief in God and a belief in religion as being very beneficial to many people, as they begin to look for answers and try to cope with and understand these kinds of traumatic issues. Having a religious belief, believing that there's somebody on your side, somebody who's helping you out through this particular problem, that everything is ultimately going to be okay, this then converts into a lot of positive ways in which we think, positive beliefs that we hold, optimistic beliefs, and there is lots of evidence to show that when we have that kind of positive belief, when we have that optimism about a situation, that we're going to be more resilient, that we're going to be less affected long-term by that particular trauma, and that ultimately we'll come out being better, being stronger, and being more adaptive in the future. Now, you know, and part of what my research looks at is those positive effects, but also sometimes the negative effects. And sometimes people will look at what's going on and say, well, you know, this is God punishing me or punishing us for the things that we've done. And we see oftentimes when that's the case that people kind of let themselves be taken over by the trauma. And I'm sure many people listening have had either themselves or a friend dealing with, you know, something like cancer. And we all know that the people who think, yes, I'm going to get through this, God is on my side, they have a much higher likelihood of succeeding and getting through that and beating the cancer, for example. And those people who think that this is God punishing me and I'm not going to be able to survive this, those are the ones who are more likely not to. So our beliefs in general are extraordinarily important in how we do in life. And so oftentimes there's a lot of evidence to support how religious beliefs can be so beneficial and can really help people to deal with and cope with these various problems and ultimately help them succeed through them.
You know, I think the you hit on so many things there along the way. I'll just reset the topic by saying we're talking with Dr. Andrew Newberg, How God Changes Your Brain. And the work you've done as a neuro researcher is to focus on kind of the before and after imagery, the before and after, the measurable effect of even so much as just thinking about God. And God here does not have to be defined as even a Judeo-Christian understanding of God in order to see a positive effect on brain function, correct?
Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, part of the thing that you're also alluding to is when we first started to look at the belief that people have in God, the first thing we started to realize is how diverse those beliefs are. But as you mentioned, and we can talk about that in a minute, but as you mentioned, when people do have a belief in God, and whether it is a Judeo-Christian perspective, whether it is a more kind of spiritualized perspective, whether it's just the sense of everything being connected. It's whatever people hold sacred to them. When they do have that sense that there is this connectedness, when there's the sense that something or someone is on their side and helping them through various issues, it can be very, very beneficial. But it is amazing how many different perspectives people take on God and how they seem to be related to so many different kinds of brain functions too, which is interesting. Our emotions, yeah. Our cognitions, and our experiences.
And in your research, you saw that different perceptions of God in different ways lit up different parts of the brain.
That's right. That's right. And when we do see, when we look at how people believe in God and what they think about God, we would run surveys. We ran online surveys about people's experiences and spiritual beliefs and so forth. And for some people, God is the more traditional, the person who's up there. But for many people, it's a feeling of energy, a feeling of a force. It's a feeling of love and compassion. Sometimes it's a feeling of fear and awe. And of course, each of those kinds of experiences, feelings of love, compassion, awe, fear, cognitive ideas about God as a person, God as a thing, all of these trigger different changes in our brain, and we can start to observe how those changes actually occur and whether or not they ultimately confer some value or benefit to those individuals.
And that goes back to kind of what I was talking about with the people in Japan. Sometimes in the moment of greatest despair, people who pray tend to make better decisions. They can slow their heart rate down. They can begin to sort of change the way their brain is functioning in the face of a crisis to a positive effect, so they get a better outcome under those circumstances.
Now,
when this research has come up in the past on Coast to Coast, and I've been doing this show here for a very long time, and I've always entertained conversations about the brain and God, even if they contradict my own personal beliefs, just because I find the subject so fascinating. And the majority of science, I would say, that has come up on this show has focused on this belief that there are certain people who have a God spot in their brain, and that a God spot that can be triggered, a God spot that can be stimulated using, whatever, a long Q-tip or whatever it was they do, and that this God spot gives the impression of another dimension, gives a feeling of euphoria, but that's all it is. It's a psychophysical reaction. It's a stimuli. It's not anything. It can't be anything actually divine. It's just merely something that's in some people's brains, but not others. Where is your research on that? And you know what I'm talking about, right? The kind of God particle argument.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, actually, you bring up some really important issues here. So first of all, in terms of whether there is one God spot of the brain, I think that's very unlikely. Our research really points to many different parts of our brain that are active or turned on when we are thinking about God or our religious and spiritual beliefs. When we think about God or our religious beliefs from an emotional perspective, when we feel something, when we feel love, compassion, joy, whatever, that activates our emotional areas, part of our brain called our limbic system. If we are just thinking about God, maybe we're having an argument with a friend or a family member about the nature of God and whether God exists or not, then we're using our cognitive processes, our frontal lobes and our parietal lobes and temporal lobes that help us to focus our mind on ideas and come up with abstract thoughts and phrases to discuss things. If we're talking about an experience, a sense of connectedness or a sense of oneness that we may have with God, that seems to be involving an area of our brain called the parietal lobe that helps us to orient ourselves to the world. So ultimately, from the perspective of whether there's one part of the brain that seems to be up, the God part, I think that's very unlikely. And I think ultimately when we look at the richness and diversity of what our beliefs about God are and what human beings have thought about God and religion throughout the ages and even throughout the world today, we see so much diversity that it seems almost impossible that there could just be this one little part that turns on. And again, I think one of the things that's been so fascinating to me is this survey that we've been running, fact, the most consistent ideas that we saw were only expressed about 10-15% of the time. So we have lots of different ways of thinking about God, and I think that implies that we're using our brain in lots of different ways. Now, you also get into this whole issue about the reality of it, and that, of course, is the really fascinating issue about, you know, whether it still, even if it's all the different parts of our brain, is it still just a manifestation of our brain, or is there something out there? And, of course, I don't think science has been able to answer that question just yet. When we look at our brain scans, really what we're saying is what happens in the brain when we think about God, feel about God, but that doesn't necessarily prove that God does or does not exist.
Well, I would argue that that's the problem. That's the place where science and faith must ultimately diverge, because you can't have if you had proof, you wouldn't need faith. And the false pursuit of proof by those people of faith, and for that matter, the false pursuit of faith by people of science, will always ultimately lead, I think, to an unsatisfying conversation. Because the idea of faith is to suspend this, to project something beyond what we can experience, what we can measure. If we could measure it and contain it, and we could put it in a jar and we could weigh it, it wouldn't be divine. It wouldn't be something other than us. If you believe in an other, then that otherness can't be measured. And if we could measure it, if we could contain it, we would be God.
Well, yes, I think that, you know, to some degree, that the part of the problem is this sort of this concept of proof and what we need. And it's always interesting when I do speak to individuals who are atheists versus those people who are religious, and you say, well, you know, well, the atheist wants proof that God exists. And one of the things that I get into an interesting discussion with them about is, well, how does one define what proof is? Because that's also a belief system. And a proof is very different for a mathematician than it is for a philosopher, than it is for a theologian, than it is for a chemist and a biologist. And, you know, if you go into a church or a synagogue and you ask people, is there proof that God exists in their lives, even though they are people of faith, they'll say, absolutely. And they'll point to the sunset and the birth of their child and many different things that go on in their life. They see God everywhere. Whereas the atheist looks at that same evidence and says, well, that's not proof. You know, I don't believe that. That constitutes proof from my perspective. So part of the overall issue is, how do we actually approach the question in the first place? And that's why I think that this whole topic of the relationship between the brain and religion, and it's a field that some people refer to as neurotheology, is a way of actually bringing science and religious ideas together to help us better understand how we as human beings approach these questions, try to understand those questions, and maybe lead to a better answer than the ones that we've gotten today. Because as you said, right now it's been very unsatisfying, and that's part of why I've tried to argue that rather than keep religious and scientific ideas separate, we need to find our ways of bringing them together to try to best understand what this all means, what the nature of reality all means to us, and maybe by some kind of combined, integrated approach, we'll actually get a little bit closer to the
answer. I agree. I agree that we'll get closer, and I hope I didn't overspeak in the sense that you don't think I feel like these things aren't compatible conversations. I'm all about, as the Pope would describe it, fides et ratio. I believe in that.
Right.
I believe that if science and religion were two sides of the top of a Ziploc bag,
right,
it would still leak.
Yeah.
it has to leak.
Right.
And it's the same sort of paradoxes that study that came out the other day in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, in which countless of Americans talked about their anger with God, and that the number of people who spent time being angry with God, and the researchers found that of that significant group of people who spend time being angry at God, a plurality of them were self-described atheists.
Right.
Okay. Well, how can you be mad at something you don't think exists?
Well, that's an interesting question.
Yeah. But anyway, so we'll get back to how God changes your brain. Dr. Andrew Newberg, The book has breakthrough findings from this man and his research partner. And we'll talk a little bit about the methodology of this and then some of the very specific things that they were able to determine, the effect of God on your brain, coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. We're talking about how God changes your brain. Leading neuro researcher has his results, and we'll talk about both the effect of even just certain types. It doesn't even have to be any formal religion. In fact, there's some interesting research on fundamentalist beliefs that they have in the book, How God Changes Your Brain, the co-author coming up next. And I would say, too, remember, you know, say a prayer for those people in Japan and around the world that are suffering still. You know, even just because suddenly our focus is on Japan, it doesn't mean there aren't people still suffering from the earthquakes in New Zealand and for that matter, any of the other natural disasters, the ones in China recently. So it happens all the time. Pray. If not for them, then do it for yourself, for the purely selfish effect that it might have on your mind. And we'll get more to that coming up next. Remember, to 1-800-RED-CROSS if you want to help out those people in Japan. And if you missed the first hour, we had a very lively conversation about both the problem with this this nuclear reactor that has shut down, perhaps even meltdown, and how that might affect all of our atmosphere. If you don't have Coast Insider, you can get that at our website, coasttocoastam.com. Go back and listen to that first hour. Very handy conversations about that and Chernobyl. And while you're there, you can link up with Dr. Andrew Newberg there under tonight's guest section, How God Changes Your Brain, next on Coast to Coast. How God Changes Your Brain, Dr. Andrew Newberg. So we were talking about some of the very specific types of research that you all did, but I want to go back one step before, and that's to focus on something that you said in the book, that you didn't come at this from the standpoint of trying to prove any one denominational belief, any one particular faith was right. And for that matter, your research partner has even perhaps more of an arm's length appreciation for faith. Would that be a fair way to describe it?
Yes. I mean, I think certainly when we're talking about studying the experience of God and the perceptions that people have about their religious and spiritual beliefs, for me personally, I feel like I need to take a bit of a neutral stance and a neutral perspective to just try to observe what people are doing when they experience God, pray, meditate, have a spiritual belief. And the more I think we can kind of keep that neutral perspective, including not necessarily trying to prove that somebody's right or wrong, but simply to try to understand where it's coming from and how it's affecting them, that to me is kind of the most effective way of trying to evaluate this very important concept. If you come at it from a very particular perspective, then so often, of course, your results are going to be biased by the beliefs that you as the investigator have. And of course, I mean, I have my own biases too, so I'm not excluded from that. But I certainly do the best that I can in my research to try to take a perspective that is at least, at the very least, open to all the different belief systems that people will have, and to be open to the possibility that any of or all of them might be right.
Right. And I just think that's important to point out, as some people might be suspecting that this is being generated from a position purely of bias and from, say, goosed research from a religious college or something like that. And that's not the case here. And your partner in research on this can speak to that, because if you were to describe his understanding of faith, his personal connection with God, how would you describe that?
Well, I think he certainly has a more spiritual perspective on it, and certainly a less theistic perspective. I don't think he has the sense of a belief in God in a very Judeo-Christian concept, but has a strong sense of a spiritual connectedness with the universe and with the rest of the world. So from that perspective, I think he has a deep understanding that people have a lot of different belief systems. He has been very active at trying to go out and explore and ask people about their belief systems and try to learn concern about them. But I think he also has a healthy respect for all of them too, realizing how important they are to people and how powerful they are in affecting who we are and how we function and how we behave.
Sure. Well, I think that's to your credit, though. That's all I'm saying is that there. Sometimes people would look at the ethos of the people involved and say that is determining the pathos of the work that they're doing. That so, and I was just saying, I think it's fair to say that the results that you all get in your research may not reflect your individual beliefs, one way or another. But some of that has to do with the fact that you, when you're looking at these brain scans, when you're looking at people who are undergoing a faith experience, whether that's as minor as meditation or not, you can actually see a measurable effect of God on the brain.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of the different brain scans that we've done, looking at people meditating, nuns in prayer, people speaking in tongues, even people specifically thinking about God, all affect our brain and to some degree affect the brain similarly and in some ways affect the brain differently. And that's been part of the basis of our research. I'd just like to tell this one of my favorite stories about this, which I think is apropos of this whole discussion about where I'm coming from. When we did study the Franciscan nuns that we reported on a couple of years ago, one of the things that was so interesting to me when I showed the nun the picture of her brain scans and what was happening in her brain when she was believing in God and praying to God, she looked at the scans and she turned to me and thanked me and said, "This is wonderful, and I appreciate knowing that it has such a deep impact on my life and on my brain and my body, and it really helps to reinforce my own beliefs and my own ways of looking at things." And of course, I was, you know, I always like making people happy, and certainly a nun, I'm glad I can make her happy. But when some of the local atheists saw the reports and saw some of my work in the books, they called me up and they said, "You know, I just want to thank you so much for showing that God is nothing more than a manifestation of the brain and that there is nothing outside of the brain." And I thought, well, you know, you make a nun happy, you make an atheist happy. I think that's good. but it's amazing how the beliefs that we hold going into any piece of information have such an impact on how we interpret that information and how we make use of it in some form or another.
Well, let me approach this from a different standpoint. Let me take the atheist position and ask you the difficult question that I would, if I were an atheist, I'd be afraid to hear. Is meditating on anything, meditating on a piece of lint in my big toe, meditating on, you know, a caterpillar out on a leaf, does meditating on anything change the brain?
Well, to some degree, yes. I mean, to some degree, everything changes the brain, and that's part of what cognitive neuroscience has been developing and learning over the past 20 years. What our research shows, though, is that when we do think about religious and spiritual ideas in particular, that there is an extensive activation of many different parts of the brain. It seems to be a much more robust kind of change that we see going on in the brain than if you did just think about, you know, a particular phrase or, you know, meditate on a particular word. That turns certain parts of the brain on, but not to the same extent and not to the same degree that we see going on when people are in active meditation or prayer. In those cases, we see lots of different parts of the brain turning on, some parts of the brain turning off, and we see many different parts of the brain being activated. And I think one of the things that has come up in my research is the notion that that the more we believe in what we are praying or meditating to, the stronger the response. In fact, we actually scanned some atheists who were contemplating God, meditating on God, and they really just didn't activate their brain very much at all. And I think that spoke to the notion that there was kind of this cognitive dissonance, that there was something that their brain just simply couldn't really wrap itself around. Whereas somebody who's a religious person, a nun, for example, who believes in God very fervently and begins to pray to God, then their brain just grabs that and wraps itself around it and turns it on in so many different ways. So I think that, you know, there is always something that's going on in the brain. The question is, to what degree, to how much, and how does that ultimately affect the beliefs that we hold about the reality out there that we are now going to interact with as human beings? And this is where I think this research ultimately can help us really understand how we as human beings experience this sense of reality.
Let me run a theory by you. I don't know. Stop me if the train leaves the rails here. But
okay.
I'm a prayerful person. I enjoy my meditative time. It comes to me in different forms, and I'm not one who believes that you have to be in extended periods of time in order to achieve a prayerful state. So,
sure.
I mean, I don't come at it with a kind of orthodoxy on what is or what isn't prayer. I think it can be all sorts of different things.
Yes.
So then, but I liken this a little bit to, and especially because of the years I had Matthew Alper on The God Part of the Brain. I had him on many times on Coast to Coast, and he was using similar brain research to try to bolster his point. But it seems to me that in all of the ways in which our brains work, the way we receive information, for example, that, you know, some people have better eyesight than others, and so they receive visual information. And when they wear glasses, that the reception of that information is improved. And certain people like me, who are literally going deaf from tinnitus, auditory information can sometimes be lost. And maybe when we think about this part of the brain that lights up, that changes, that seems to reflect an experience of God, we tend to only think about it in terms of a transmitter instead of a receiver. And
right.
There's some people like who these atheists of whom you just spoke, maybe they just don't have the physical ability to receive that information, that divine information in some way, or a divine experience is something that their brain is kept from experiencing, much in the same way that perhaps some people experience other types of handicaps. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, there's several issues in regard to what you were just mentioning. So one of the things which is very interesting is just this notion that as a species, as people, all of us, I think that very likely some of us are, there's a bell curve, that some of us, yourself, for example, find so many different kinds of practices and ways of being spiritual, for example, and it's something that comes very easily to them. And I've had so many people come up to me after I give a talk or a presentation, and they say, you know, I've tried all these different kinds of meditation, and everyone's better than the next one. I love all of them. And I've had other people come up to me and say, you know, I've tried all these different kinds of meditation. I don't get it. It's not happening for me. What's wrong with me, they'll say. And I would say, you know, well, there's nothing inherently wrong with you. It may be that you just haven't found the right kind of practice that works for you. It may be that, as you mentioned, that it's just not something that comes easily to somebody. And so that's one part of the discussion. Part of it, too, is how we interpret the experiences and how we interpret the things that we feel. So I think to some degree, you know, everybody has felt something move them in some way or another, a beautiful sunset, a Mozart concerto. And for a religious person, they convert that into a notion about religious and spiritual views. For a non-religious person, they convert that into a scientific perspective on the world. So there's another element that's not just what we perceive, but what we do with what we perceive. And that becomes a very important element in terms of how we interpret what we're doing and how we make sense of our world. And then I think the final thing that is also important to us is just kind of how people really start to experience these different kinds of ideas and beliefs and how they, you know, how do they actually make meaning out of them, and what do they do with them? And that, to me, is something that is a fascinating issue. It's a fascinating topic for us to study, because we can see so many different ways in which religious and spiritual beliefs affect people and do so in so many powerful different ways that I think that this is where our research can ultimately go to help us understand, you know, not just the perceptions of these experiences, the ease with which people have those experiences, but what they do with them. And in fact, you know, one of the studies that we looked at were changes in people who were spiritual or the difference in the brain between somebody who is spiritual versus somebody who is not. And we see some very profound differences. And it raised a very interesting chicken and the egg kind of question, which was, were these changes in their brain between the spiritual and the non-spiritual people, were they there because that was how they were built and that this is something that just came very naturally for them? Or is it something that changed over time because they had been spiritual for so many years? And we've started to do, and this is what's in our book, How God Changes Your Brain, we've started to do longitudinal studies where we take people who have never been particularly religious or spiritual and start them on a meditation program and find that their brain actually does change over time. So certainly there's probably a combination of the two, that there's a combination of how we're built and how we look at things, as well as how we ultimately change our brain over time as we continue to engage in those particular ideas and beliefs.
Has anybody ever done a longitudinal study on the relationship between personality types and faith?
Well, I think that the closest that closest thing that I've seen in that is actually some behavioral geneticists, in particular a gentleman, Dean Hamer, who looked at the genetic contribution to religious and spiritual belief, did find that people who had this sort of a sense of self-transcendence, which isn't quite personality, but this feeling of themselves being able to transcend themselves and so forth, that seemed to be associated with greater feelings of religious and spiritual beliefs, and actually has a predisposition to a particular genetic type that codes for a receptor in the brain that regulates our serotonin and our dopamine neurotransmitters in the brain. And people have certainly done some other studies, not so much physiological, but to try to understand the differences in how religious people think versus those who are non-religious. And on one hand, there are different thought patterns that occur in people who are religious versus those who are not. But on the other hand, both approaches lead to mistakes that are related to the ways in which they look at the world. And the brief example I'll give is that if you show people like Rorschach test kind of things, there was a study that was done that showed that the people who were religious saw more things in those Rorschach tests, and in particular saw more things that were in fact actually in those images, but sometimes saw things that weren't there as well. Whereas people who were non-religious never saw the things that weren't there, but sometimes missed the things that actually were there. So we all make mistakes in how we interpret our world. Our brain is doing the best job it can in helping to interpret the world, but we make them in different ways, and I think that that's part of what ultimately leads to our different belief systems.
The book is How God Changes Your Brain. I guess specifically, I was thinking about before I went into seminary, I took a Myers-Briggs test, and they came back with the results on, you know, for people that don't know what a Myers-Briggs personality test, it's based on Jungian archetypes of personalities and cognitive styles. So as it turned out, the personality group in which I fall into in the Myers-Briggs test and all of its complexity or simplicity, depending how you look at it, that personality group is the second least likely to go into seminary. Hmm. So second least likely to pursue an interest in faith or organized religion. And yet, at the same time, I tried to find out whether anybody had ever done a comprehensive, you know, sort of cross-discipline study to see whether or not Myers-Briggs personality testing could ever determine whether or not somebody would become a person of faith, period, and whether there were certain Myers-Briggs personality profiles that were likeliest to become worshipers. And that there would be others that just would never, they wouldn't take just by the virtue of the way their personalities lined up.
Well, yes, and I don't know if anybody's done that, for as you mentioned at the moment, but I think this is the kind of study that I would love to see us do. And I'd actually like to mention to the listeners, another book that I've just published called Principles of Neurotheology talks about all the different kinds of studies that we could potentially do, and including things about understanding the nature of our personalities, our beliefs, our emotions, and how they affect whether or not we will pursue religious and spiritual beliefs, how we'll pursue them, and again, still ultimately coming back to whether or not there's a realness to it, a meaning that we can make out of it that changes the ways in which we look at the world and the ways in which we think about our world.
Well, if you ever do that, if you ever find if there's ever somewhere in your neurotheological, you know, pursuit or some graduate student that ever does that I'd be very curious about Myers-Briggs results as it relates to the likelihood of somebody becoming a person of faith. I think it would be very helpful to religious groups so they would know who to just reach out to. They'll know who not to bother with, or if there were such a thing as people that would be less likely to ever have a belief in God. All right, so How God Changes Your Brain, Breakthrough Findings from a Leading Neuroscientist. We'll talk with that leading neuroscientist after the top of the hour. In his response to the number of people like Christopher Hitchens and other well-known writers who say the whole problem with Western society is a belief in God. Next on Coast to Coast.